Best Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibilities.
Hello and welcome to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and thank you all for tuning into the show today. Oh my God, we're going to be talking about a topic that is fascinating to me, and I hope that it is just as fascinating to you. We're going to be talking about digging for the truth, the secret initiation of Jesus at Qumran. And so let me just make a couple of quick announcements, and we're going to get right into the show, because I have like 3 pages of questions that hopefully we'll get through. If you're enjoying the show and you'd like to sign up for our monthly newsletter and get reminders of the upcoming shows, please go to www.justenergyradio.com and you can sign up there. At justenergyradio.com, you can also check out our archives. We've been on air for 2.5 years and we have 2.5 years worth of archives. And if you're listening to the show on Blog Talk Radio, please do choose us as a favorite and we would really appreciate that. So tonight's guest is Robert Feather, and we're talking to him right out of the UK. So let me tell you a little bit about him, and we're just going to start digging and exploring the secrets about Jesus at Qumran. Robert Feather is a metallurgist, engineer, journalist, and scholar of world religions. He is the founding editor of The Metallurgist, editor of Weighing and Measuring, and the author of The Mystery of the Copper Scrolls of Qumran. So please welcome to Just Energy Radio, Robert Feather. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Dr. Rita. Good to speak to you.
Nice to talk to you, especially, you know, you're overseas and coming in live just to talk to me and my listeners. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to it.
So let me ask you this. How does someone who has obviously an in-depth background in metallurgy get interested in the Copper Scrolls and Jesus and the Essenes? How does that all tie together for you?
It's probably accidental almost. About 10, 11 years ago, I went up to Cambridge and toured around and went into a library called the Taylor Schechter Library, where they have the Genitza collection, which is a collection of old Hebraic and historical texts that date back to about the 6th century AD that were found in a Cairo synagogue in Cairo, in old Cairo. And someone there mentioned to me that there was a copper scroll amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there was a connection between the Genitza scrolls and some that were found at the Dead Sea Scrolls. And being a metallurgist, I just could not resist following it up. I just sold a publishing business and was looking around for something to do. And before I knew it, I was researching the copper scroll, one of the Dead Sea Scrolls.
Fascinating. I mean, I remember, you know, well, it played in the U.S. I'm not sure how far it was, you know, a whole special on TV about the Copper Scroll. Was that your work that they were using as kind of the basis of that show?
It may well have been. I did a documentary called The Pharaoh's Holy Treasure after my first book was published in 1999. And I've contributed and appeared in a number of shows that have dealt with the Copper Scroll, most recently one with National Geographic on Digging for the Truth, which was about the Copper Scroll.
And I think that's the one I saw.
May well be. It led me to other things, and I started studying comparative religions, ancient history, and archaeology. It's like one of those things. I was brought up as a scientist, knew very little really about history and archaeology, and there was a vacuum in my knowledge, and it was almost screaming out to be filled. So I just had to learn more about the Dead Sea Scrolls and the origins of this mysterious Copper Scroll.
And so, you know, talking about the Copper Scroll is going to be kind of setting a foundation for where we're going to be moving forward. So why don't we just spend a couple of minutes doing a brief review of the Copper Scroll and your findings in the scrolls?
Okay. Well, to set the scene, it's a blazing hot day. We're at one of the lowest points below sea level on Earth, 1,385 feet below sea level. We're by the Dead Sea, about 15 kilometers from Jerusalem, at a place called Qumran. And we're watching 10 Bedouin and a French archaeologist by the name of Henri de Contenson. It's 20th of March, 1952, and all of a sudden he comes rushing out of a cave that they've been exploring, and he's got something in his hand. And what he's got in his hand are two rolled-up, heavily oxidized pieces of material, broken in two, which he then took back to the École Biblique in East Jerusalem, and they started studying them. And they could see Hebrew writing, an ancient form of Hebrew writing, in mirror image on the outside of these two pieces of very, very heavily oxidized copper. And briefly, it took them another 4 years, 1955 and 56, before they were able to actually slice open the two segments of Copper Scroll and read the text inside. And it turned out to be a list of 64 places, approximately 64, where treasure had been hidden. Detailed descriptions of where large amounts of gold, silver, jewelry, oils, anointing oils, robes, other scrolls had been hidden. And if you added up all the amounts described in the Copper Scroll, it came to millions of dollars worth of treasure.
Wow. I want to find it.
Well, from 1956 onwards, people have searched all over Israel looking for it. I think there's been at least 8 major expeditions, including the first one by John Allegro, who was the one of the people involved in the excavations at Qumran and based at the École Biblique, a Dominican monastery in East Jerusalem. And he was one of the team of people brought in to help translate all the other scroll material that was coming in from the other scrolls. The first one had been found in 1947 in Cave 1, and from then on, another 11 caves disposed all sorts of other scriptural material, biblical material, 2,000 years older than any previous biblical material that we had. So they were of incredible importance. And he had come from Oxford and Manchester University, and he encouraged the team of mainly Catholic priests in East Jerusalem, who were in charge of excavating and translating the scroll material, to let him take it to Manchester College of Science and Technology and try and open it. And so he was the first one to translate it, and the people back in East Jerusalem didn't like what they heard, because the idea that this, what they believed was an ascetic, devout, religious community at Qumran, residing there from about 150 BC to 68 AD, they didn't want them to have loads of wealthy material. They'd already decided that they were a very devout people who eschewed wealth and money. So the idea that they had this kind of treasure was an anathema to them.
But I thought that even though they've done these expeditions to look for it, one, they haven't had any success, and I guess the bigger problem they're having is that they're not finding any, like, reference point in the Israel area that totally corresponds to kind of the directions, you know, where the magic X is in the scrolls?
Well, that is the puzzle, or was the puzzle, let's say, because I believe I solved the puzzle. I can sort of relate to you. The details, the descriptions are very, very detailed. You know, it would say in the fortress, which is in the Vale of Achon, 40 cubits, cubic being about 50 centimeters, under the steps, enter from the east, and you'll find a money chest and a contents of a weight of 17 talents. And it goes on and on in great detail about the description of the places. And people tried to assign all sorts of geographical locations to these descriptions, but none of them turned up with any results whatsoever. And people are still searching. There's an American character called Wendell Jones, Jim Barfield, and all sorts of people are still digging all over the place saying, they know where it is, they know where it is, but nothing has ever been found yet.
But there was something that you discovered in working with the Copper Scrolls, correct? That was kind of startling to a lot of people?
Well, yes, I think so. And when you look within the text of the Copper Scroll, it's in an ancient form of Hebrew, consistent with Herodian period, which is about the first century BC and coming into the time of Jesus, that sort of period. And within the Hebrew text are 14 Greek letters interspersed. And these have always been a puzzle to scholars. They've sort of suggested all sorts of things of what they might mean. And I was studying the Copper Scroll text, having looked at the material side. I mean, obviously the metal content was something of great interest to me, and questions that I was asking, no one had bothered to ask. How pure was the copper? Well, it turned out to be 99.9% pure copper. And why were they engraving on copper at this time of history? No one else was engraving on pure copper at that time, and hadn't been for at least 500 years. So it was unique in many, many respects. And when I looked in the text and looked at these 14 Greek letters, I took the first 10 letters, put them together, and lo and behold, I read the name Akhenate. Now, an Akhenate is as close as you can get in Greek to the name of an Egyptian pharaoh by the name of Akhenaten. And he lived about...
Wasn't he King Tut's, you know, as far as they know, dad?
Possibly, yes, yes. Yes, he was certainly the pharaoh one before Tutankhamun. There may have been an intermediate pharaoh by the name of Smenkhkahara, but he started out with the name of Amenhotep IV and changed it to Akhenaten because he got religion. He suddenly came to the incredible realization that there should be only one omnipotent, all-powerful, invisible God. So he threw Egypt's religious structure into turmoil and introduced what, you know, you can only describe as the first period of pure monotheism in the world. And his name to appear in this copper scroll was quite staggering. Most scholars, when I expressed it to them, were just completely baffled, amazed, and a lot of them said, well, it's just impossible, I can't believe it, you know, how can you connect this Jewish community living around the time of Jesus right the way back, 1,000 miles away, to an Egyptian pharaoh living 1,000 years earlier? Well, that connection I think I've now made so firm that there can be very, very little doubt that it is a genuine knowledge link between the two communities.
Well, and Akhenaten was known to have a monotheistic religion, which the Jews, you know, have a monotheistic religion. And so, you know, one of the things that I had heard was, who came first? Did the Jews come and influence Akhenaten, or did Akhenaten influence the people who turned out to be the Jews?
Well, once he had established himself on the throne, the Pharaoh's word became as a god speaking almost, and what he wanted, he got. And he actually started destroying all the temples to idols, carving out inscriptions to Amun, Khons, and Ra, all the other pagan gods in Egypt, and replacing them with his name for God, which was Aton. And the T and D in Egyptian pronunciation are interchangeable, so you could easily say that he was worshipping a god called Adon, and Adonai is the Hebrew name for God. That has come down all the way through into the Jewish and the Christian religion, I believe. And unfortunately, when he died about 17 years after initiating this sort of window of pure monotheism, Egypt reverted to paganism and idolatryism, and his holy city, a brand new city he'd built in Middle Egypt by the name of, now it's called El Amarna, was completely destroyed. So there's a real query as to how did this information get out right the way down to Canaan, to Israel, to Qumran, 1,000 years later. But there is an explanation. There is a very, very clear explanation.
Well, I mean, one of the things that you talk about in your book, The Secret Initiation of Jesus at Qumran, is that you believe that Jacob and Joseph, you know, the early people in Jewish history, you know, because there was Abraham and then Jacob and Joseph, were actually in Egypt at the time of Akhenaten.
Yes, yes. If you follow the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, the descriptions of Jacob and Joseph and his brothers, Joseph's brothers, who were to become the 12 tribes of Israel, together with Ephraim and Manasseh, two of Joseph's sons. When I went to Amarna, we went there to film, and I explored all over the place, and I came across, I mean, although it was, if you go there now, it's a complete, vast, open area, which is completely barren. It's archaeological remains where the archaeologists are still exploring and digging. But there are tombs to the north of vast plain on the east side of the Nile, where inscriptions and reliefs inside the tombs show what the temple and the people and the town of Amarna was like in 135 BC. And one of the inscriptions on the wall shows what I believe is a picture of Joseph leading a procession to Adon, in the great temple at what was called then Akhetaten, the place of the horizon of the sun. And if you look at a close-up of this image, this drawing of a figure, a bald-headed figure with a sort of a fillet around his forehead, on his leg is a bandage, and he's dressed completely differently from all the other priests in the procession. And Akhenaten is in the procession, and so is his wife Nefertiti, the most beautiful, beautiful queen of Egypt. And I believe that is a picture of Joseph, and that he was the vizier, the second in command, as the Bible says, to the Pharaoh. And his father, Jacob, the Bible relates, became a great friend of the Pharaoh. The Bible never names the Pharaoh that Joseph and Jacob interact with. But it doesn't make sense that Jacob, who's going to and is already perhaps believing in one God, that he would befriend a pagan Pharaoh. he would befriend a pharaoh who had similar ideas to him. Who got the idea first? I don't know. I like to think that it was a kind of a synthesis between Pharaoh Akhenaten and Jacob, the ideas of one God, monotheism.
Yeah, because in the Bible it talks about God's covenant with Abraham and, you know, Abraham trying to kill Isaac, and they made the whole covenant in the belief in one God. You know, so at least according to biblical accounts, you know, that was already set up before Joseph and Jacob ended up in Egypt.
Yes, and the whole ambience, if you go to Amarna, it's halfway between Cairo and Luxor in Egypt, and a complete isolated area. But the whole ambience is resonant of biblical names. There's a river to this day going off right opposite the great temple that Pharaoh Akhenaten built, and it's called Bar Yosef, Joseph's River. There's a village called Amram, and there's another one to the north called Shachabed. They are names that had the flavor, biblical flavor. Amram was the father of Moses, and Shachabed was the mother. I think they are making the Bible was making a deliberate move to say Moses is associated with this place, and by Yosef, the river of Joseph, he was there.
Hmm, interesting. Okay, well, let's kind of keep moving along here. You know, because our conversation is about these scenes, and with them being monotheistic, I mean, you know, Jews are monotheistic, Akhenaten was monotheistic, but one of the things that you talk about is that the religion or the philosophy that the Essenes had was more reminiscent of the philosophies of Akhenaten as opposed to the philosophies of mainstream Judaism.
Yes. And that's
so how did that happen? I mean, because there's a lot of years between Akhenaten and, you know, Jesus's time, or, you know, 150 BC, where you really start kind of hearing about or seeing the writings of these scenes.
Well, I mean, that's such a good question, and I know we've got quite a bit of time, but
that's why I'm asking it so early.
I'm trying to go through it very, very briefly, but some of the beliefs of this strange community at Qumran, and they're all male, and they spent their whole day and night praying and writing and studying, and they believed in a different form of Judaism. They were monotheistic, but their reading was very, very different. They believed in predestination. They believed in good and evil. They followed a solar calendar. These are the things that are absolutely the same as the philosophy that Akhenaten was espousing. And there are many, many other things. Their customs, their building itself at Qumran was aligned exactly to within a degree of the alignment of the great temple that Akhenaten built at Amarna. And he built that temple so that the rising sun would come right in to the door and illuminate the Holy of Holies. And the Qumran Essenes seem to know about the alignment of this temple in Egypt, because they built their own prayer hall in exact alignment with it. And there are many, many other things that you find in their text. Particularly, they continually refer to the appointment of priests at the time of Jacob. Now, that doesn't make sense in the biblical context, because you didn't have priests in the normal understanding until there was a sanctuary, a tabernacle that Moses built in the desert when they came out of Egypt. So you didn't need priests before that. So what are priests doing before the time of Moses? The Qumran Essenes texts relate very closely to some of the things at Amarna. And there are three examples which I think are absolutely potent, which back up this word, Akhenaten, in the Copper Scroll. Other scrolls also describe events and geography at this long-lost city. And you don't have to look very far to see it. And it, the puzzle to me now is why biblical scholars, historians, aren't prepared to look at what I'm saying very carefully. There are some. There's a professor at Cincinnati University, Michigan University, Professor Harold Ellens, who has gone through my work in great detail and just says he's 100% behind what I say. He says to him it all makes absolute sense. And there are a lot of other scholars coming around to that, agreeing with me. Biblical scholars, particularly who are studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Hebrew texts, theologians, philosophers, historians, have great difficulty in taking on board what I'm saying because it undermines what they've been teaching for years and years.
But how do they sit there and, you know, correlate, you know, if they're talking like your example about a lost city, you know, how do they associate that with, you know, Israel or Palestine or, you know, that whole area there? Because the only really lost cities that you ever hear about are Sodom and Gomorrah, and I don't think they would be referring to them.
Well, yes, it's odd, but there are really high walls between people who work on Egyptology and people who work on Middle East, Canaanite, Lebanon, Levant archaeology. They don't talk to each other. It's a different language they're looking at, so they don't study the same kind of texts. Dead Sea Scroll scholars, biblical scholars, will know Aramaic, they'll know Greek, they'll know Assyrian, Nabataean. They will know all those kind of languages. They won't know Egyptian, and vice versa. Egyptian scholars will know hieroglyphics, demotics, hieratic, and they won't understand Hebrew. You have to look at both. And then you begin to see the connections. Someone like Sarah Israelit Groll has done a lot of work on this direction. And when I first came up with this suggestion that the Greek letters read the name Akhenaten, scholars said, well, we don't believe you. How do you know the name's disappeared? It's not even known in Egyptian history. So I went to two of the world's greatest experts on Egypt, on hieroglyphics and Greek. Professor John Tate at University College London and Professor David Rosalie at Manchester University, and I showed them the letters and my suggested reading, and they studied what I suggested, and they said what I had come up with was very plausible. Akhenaten's name could be read from these 10 Greek letters. And people still have difficulty with it because it's a problem for them. It means that they've got everything wrong. They've got pretty well the whole of their lecturing, written career with something huge missing from it.
So let me ask this question. You know, we're talking about the religious tradition of Akhenaten, but how do we even know so much about him and his life?
Okay.
Or anything. I mean, because, you know, they tore down his city. And other than some graves, you know, stuff that they left behind and didn't do anything with, how do we know anything about him? I mean, it seems like they tried to wipe him out of history.
Yes. They found two main areas of knowledge about Akhenaten and what was going on at this now lost city. There was a set of what are called the Amarna letters, which were clay tablets. They're now mainly in the Cairo Museum. And they were a whole collection of hundreds of letters that Akhenaten and his father wrote to the vassal states in Canaan, and letters that came back. And in those letters, we learn a lot about his teaching, his understanding, and what he was doing, what he wanted from them. He was a genius in many ways. I mean, he changed the whole direction of architecture, of art, and of religion, and philosophy It brought about a complete new age. And the Amana letters reflect a lot of his philosophy. The other main source of information is the caves that I mentioned. There are tombs, a line of tombs, of about 12, 13 caves, where courtiers and nobles from his reign were buried. There are no, virtually, I don't think there's any bodies ever been found there. There's a tomb for him and Nefertiti, and there were no bodies there. But his form of burial was very simple. He said, no more of the paraphernalia.
Robert, we need to take a quick break. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. We're talking to Robert Feather about his book, The Secret Initiation of Jesus at Qumran. His website is www.robert-feather.com. And we will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today.
Crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationships, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Before we get back to the show, I want to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio this evening. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit soulhealer.com.
Now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Well, you know, if I unmute the mic, we would be doing a whole lot better. So we seem to have lost Robert off the phone line, and I'm hoping that he will call back in so that we can continue this interesting conversation about the Essenes. And so what we're going to do at this point in time is go ahead and open up the phone line. If you have any questions, you have any comments that you would like to make about the discussion that we've had so far, and we can talk about Egypt and Judaism and the Essenes and just kind of keep going until hopefully Robert turns back up. Anyway, so one of the things that, because I did read Robert's book, it makes me feel like a little bit of a geek because I read the book cover to cover and found it really, really interesting, you know, some of the topics that he brought up in there. One of the things that he talks about, you know, to validate the contents of the Dead Sea Scrolls. So the Dead Sea Scrolls, he was saying, was they were found in Qumran. I think this is him. Hold on. Let's see. Robert, is that you?
Yes.
Hi. If you could turn your computer mic down or your computer speakers down.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine.
No, I seem to have got the station on as well.
Hold on, let's see. Turn down the speaker volume on your computer, your outgoing speaker volume.
Computer mic down or your computer speaker down.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
I think you've got the station on as well. We lost him again. You know what, we're going to go and take another quick commercial break, and I'm going to try to get him back on the line. You have a caller. Well, let's just give him a chance to call back in. All right, here we go. Caller. Hello, caller. Hello, caller from the 818 area code.
Yes.
Hello.
This is Derek. Dr. Rita, this is Derek Spark.
Hi, Derek. How are you?
Oh, you can hear me. Great. That's great. I have a question for Dr. Leather, or whatever his name is. Dr. Feather, I mean.
Well, you're going to have to ask me the question because he is not here. But I'll answer
it. The question is, why were the scrolls made out of copper, now a very valuable kind of metal, why were they made of copper instead of parchment or papyrus or something like that, papyrus or whatever, something like that?
Well, what did they believe?
Was this some advantage or something like that?
Well, I mean, what they believe is that, you know, a form like papyrus or something like that would fade over time, and actually he's there. So let's see if we can get him on as well. Robert, so are you there, Robert?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay, so Hello. We just had a caller leave a question. Well, he's on the air too, and the question was, why did they make the copper scrolls out of copper as opposed to something like papyrus or, you know, other material that was typically used during that point in time in history?
Well, I think he's probably answered the question himself. Copper was a material that they thought wouldn't deteriorate. Papyrus, certainly outside of Egypt, outside of a very, very dry climate, would deteriorate, and they knew that. So they wanted something that would last indefinitely, they hoped, and they chose copper. And where they got the copper from is also a very baffling question.
Because?
Well, because no one else was engraving on copper, and no one had copper of that purity. The only place I could find where copper of that purity, 99.9%, and the various chemical ingredients, the minor elements, matched very closely the kind of copper that was available only in Egypt of about 1,000 years prior. So that raises all sorts of very fascinating problems. Did they actually bring copper out with them when they left Egypt? Did they have a store and access to copper from Egypt? Where did they get the technology of engraving on copper? No one was engraving on copper at the time that they were writing this material down. And I think they were copying from a very old, probably completely deteriorated papyrus script, and they wanted to make something that was more permanent. Everyone was engraving on bronze at that period now, because that took an image, an impression much more readily.
That answer your question, Derek?
That's fine. You said something about them. You just said something about them recording on what sounded like bronze. What was that word?
Bronze.
Bronze.
Hello?
I don't get it. I'm sorry. I don't get the word.
Bronze.
It's an alloy of copper
bronze,
and
bronze. Tin. Yes, yes. Got it. Got it now. Thank you. Okay. Thanks so much.
Bye. All right. Thanks, Derek. Bye. Well, okay. So this is exciting. So let's kind of talk about the whole religious concept of it. You know, because one of the fundamental aspects of Judaism is the concept of the return of a messianic figure who will restore the temple. You know, and in the Bible and the other texts that have been discovered, you know, the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Nag Hammadi texts, et cetera, when did this belief or a desire for a return to the temple first appear?
Well, it, strangely enough, seems to be extant before the destruction of the first temple that Solomon built around about 950-960 BC. There was, in Isaiah's texts, a desire to rebuild the temple even before it had been destroyed, which is weird. And this messianic desire to recreate a messianic age, I think, goes all the way back to the lost golden age of Akhenaten, when a great temple was built by him, a huge temple, on the banks of the Nile. And just to complete what I was saying before the break, the tombs of his courtiers in the hills carry lots of inscriptional material that we've learned an awful lot about the design, architecture of the city that he built and the temple that he built. And one thing, amongst many, many others, which point absolutely convincingly to an understanding of what was going on here, is an inscription in the tomb of Ai. It's called the Great Hymn to Aten, and it's believed to be written by Akhenaten himself. It's a long, huge hieroglyphic wall of inscriptions. And lo and behold, when it's translated into English, it paraphrases, or let's put it the other way around, Psalm 104 in the Bible paraphrases this hymn, almost phrase for phrase, word for word. So someone had to have been there, memorized or taken down a version of it and taken it all the way through, and eventually it ends up in mainstream Bible as Psalm 104.
Well, see, and you mentioned Isaiah just a second ago and about his desire to rebuild the temple. So why don't biblical scholars kind of catch little discrepancies like that? I mean, because to me that would you know, how could you want to rebuild a temple if the temple didn't even exist? I mean, what do they have to say about inconsistencies such as that? Or do they just ignore them?
Well, they do two things. They ignore them, or they assign them to imagination and visionary images. They do the same with Ezekiel. They did the same with two major, major scrolls that were found at Qumran amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's rather, I don't know if you have the phrase, the expression in American, that if something talks like a duck, walks like a duck, looks like a duck, it is a duck.
Mm-hmm.
And the reverse applies to the situation that you just suggested. Why don't they query these things? You've got Ezekiel. You've got this Psalm 104, which is exactly the same as a psalm in hieroglyphics, written 1,000 years before Qumran. It gets into the Bible. You've got the temple scroll, and you've got Ezekiel, and you've got the New Jerusalem scroll, or so-called New Jerusalem scroll, because that's the only place they can think of that this scroll is talking about. And all the translations and people who discuss it talk as if it's talking about Jerusalem. But it isn't. It's another one of these ducks. Neither the temple scroll, the so-called New Jerusalem scroll, which I call the New Akhetaten scroll, or Ezekiel ever mention Jerusalem when they're describing the temple. So it's not a duck. It's not Jerusalem. It's another place. And if you look at these scrolls, it's patently obvious. But they do what you say, unfortunately, Rita. They decide, well, it doesn't work. We can't understand it. So we'll either ignore it or say it's imaginary.
Well, and they like doing that. Everybody has friends, and, you know, they can't possibly be real things that have happened to them or that they experienced in their lives. You know, I have a question that came up for me about the Copper Scrolls. You know, you talked about the dialect of Hebrew. You know, I don't know if it was Hebrew or Aramaic that was on there. But could that, excuse, it was Hebrew? Could it actually date to an older period of time and that they just don't recognize that it's actually in much older version?
Well, I think you put your finger right on it, because some of the texts, when you look at them, when the name of God is written, they don't use a contemporary form of Hebrew. They use a form of Hebrew which dates back to the 8th, 9th, 10th century BC, to 800 or 900 years before the time that they're writing. I think it's rather like someone having a copy of Shakespeare copying it down because their copy of Shakespeare is falling apart, and they're copying it down into modern English. But some of the words stay in the ancient form, and that gives it away. Everyone who studies the Copper Scroll and some of the other Dead Sea Scrolls says, well, a lot of them date to 300, 400, 500, maybe 800 years before they were actually copied or written down. So yes, there is indications of a much, much older lineage. I mean, the Temple Scroll is a fascinating one, and if we want to have a little divergence for a moment, and
sure.
And it illustrates almost absolutely concretely that the people with this Qumran Essenes, we call them Essenes, they never called themselves Essenes, that was a name applied to them by Josephus, Philo, and Pliny, Roman Jewish historians of the period. They talked about this community living in isolation by the Dead Sea, and they called them Essenes, and so that's the name we refer to them. But they themselves called themselves the Yachad, the Sons of Light, the Meek, the Saints, and those names crop up in the New Testament. And when we come on to talk about how does Christianity relate to this community, then those terms become highly significant, because the New Testament uses exactly the same terms that the community at Qumran called itself by. The evidence in the Temple Scroll, which was found, recovered by Yigdal Yadin, in 1967, when the Israelis reconquered, I don't know if that's the right word, but in the war of 67, they took possession of the whole of the West Bank and Sinai, and that was under their control. And Yadin sent one of his lieutenants down to Bethlehem because he'd heard about a scroll that had been acquired by someone called Kando, who had found some of the earlier Dead Sea Scroll material. And this Kando, who was an amateur or a part-time dealer in antiquities and a shoemaker, had hidden under his bed one of the most important Dead Sea Scrolls of all time. And they eventually gave him $105,000 in compensation, because they took it from him without any sort of by your leave. This was the longest scroll of any of the Dead Sea Scrolls. It's about 28 feet long, and detailed descriptions of a temple and a city in which that temple was to be built. And Yadin was the first person to translate it and analyze it. And he said it's describing a real temple, a temple that must have existed. This is the words in his book, and most other scholars have difficulty with it because of the description. The description is of a temple so vast that it will not fit in Jerusalem. It's 1,600 cubits by 600 cubits. A cubit is about 50 centimeters, so we're talking about 800 meters by 300 meters. It's nearly a half a mile. It's a huge, huge building. It would fall off the end of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Far, far bigger than that area could possibly accommodate a temple. So what do scholars make of it? They cannot make anything of it. They just are confused. They say, well, it's a visionary temple of the future. But why would anyone describe, and this author writes in great authority, as if it's the words of God, how to build this temple? And there are so many details, architectural and archaeological and dimensional details, that fit the great temple that Akhenaten built. You can't get away from it. The dimension.
So has somebody gone and taken the measurements and stuff that are in that scroll, and then, you know, kind of done like a little survey map and overlaid it over Akhenaten's city?
Yes. A number of people have done it, and I've done it. And anyone can do it. You can get a map of the great temple at Amarna from any Egyptian textbook, or just Google it on the web, and then look at the dimensions given in the temple scroll, which is a scroll clearly 1,000 years older in terms of the time it was copied down, but the content knows the details of this temple that was destroyed 1,000 years earlier. That dimension I gave you of 800 meters by 300 meters is the exact dimension of the excavated outline of the great temple at Amarna to this day.
Well, let me ask this question, and correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't they find a lot of artifacts from Amarna actually incorporated into other temple sites where they used, you know, bricks and carved stones for fill, and that's how they found a bunch of the sculpture work and reliefs from Amarna in other temple sites?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Your knowledge is good on that. One of the things that Pharaoh Akhenaten brought in was a new form of building. He created what was called a talatat, which is a cubic brick, made of cubic dimensions. And when the city was destroyed, the people who destroyed it took a lot of the material and used it down at Karnak for rebuilding temples. And a lot of it was used as infill. Absolutely right.
Let me ask this question. You talked about the temple scroll. So were there any references to, like, imagery or reliefs that were in the temple that correspond to reliefs that they have discovered, you know, other places? Does that make sense to you?
Yes, it does. And you don't need to go very far to discover them. Some of the material that was used as infill has been recovered and put together back in a continuous relief of scenes from Amarna. There's one particular one at the Luxor Museum, which shows a whole wall with scenes of activity at Amarna. And if you look at it, you'll see that one of the scenes shows a priest, several priests, parading through the temple, the great temple at Amarna, with a scroll, holding a scroll very much like, almost identical to a Torah scroll that's paraded around synagogues to this day. There's another example, too, another very clear example of a relief at Amarna showing, this is in the New York Museum, Metropolitan Museum in New York, the relief of a princess being baptized with water. And that idea, and you can see the hand of the Aten, might be a bit confusing to understand that an invisible god could have a hand, but they used a kind of mental crutch, if you like, of a sun with rays beaming down from it, with hands and an ankh sign, the sign of life and beneficence to the people, coming radiating down from the sun. And that's in the Metropolitan Museum in Washington, and that shows an example of baptism. And baptism was one of the central features at Qumran. They picked that up. One of the other sort of rituals that clearly was going on at the Mana, they knew about and picked it up. And that baptism ritual gets picked up into Christianity by John the Baptist.
Well, and in Judaism, they go by moon cycle and not by the solar cycle, correct? I mean, their calendar is based on, you know, the cycle of the moon. You know, all the holidays are based on the cycle of the moon and not on a solar calendar, but a lunar calendar.
Yes, yes, yes. And that's another marked difference between this strange community. They followed a solar calendar, which is exactly what Akhenaten, at the time of Akhenaten, that was the calendar that he followed, which meant that your festivals were out of phase with the rest of the Jewish community around you. So they were a completely... Well, aberrant is possibly the wrong word, because I think they actually were following the purest form of the religion as enunciated by probably Jacob and Akhenaten together. The calendar that the Jewish people follow today is a lunar solar calendar, you're right, and it moves around through the year. It's not like the Muslim calendar, which is completely lunar and cycles all the way through the year. The Jewish calendar has days and years added to bring it back into roughly into phase with the seasons. But each festival falls on a different day each year, yes. But for the Qumran Essenes, or the Yachad as we should really call them, their festivals always fell on the same day because they follow the solar calendar.
We're going to be hitting a break, so I don't want to start on a whole big topic here, but how about when we come back from break, we talk about, you know, kind of bring it up into history. So we started with Akhenaten and Joseph and Jacob, you know, and then the Jews leave Egypt, you know, and we have the whole Moses thing going on and end up in Israel. And let's kind of pick it up from Moses and move forward so we can get into Jesus and Christianity. Sound good? Okay, we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages. I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today.
You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.
Before we get back to the show, I want to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio this evening. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. We're here talking to Robert Feather about the secret initiation of Jesus at Qumran. Fascinating conversation. We have so much to talk about, but I'm going to go ahead and say that the phone lines are open. The call-in number is 646-200-0698. That's 646-200-0698. So, Robert, as promised before the break, here's the question. Okay, so the Jews leave Egypt. You know, they go with Moses. And so did the group who would become the Essenes form part of that group that left with Moses and, you know, had the whole experience at Mount Sinai? Or did they leave Egypt at some other point in time and were actually separate from that whole 40 years in the desert experience?
No, I think they are the ancestors of the community that lived at Qumran, and they were the Levites. We obviously, from the evidence in wall reliefs at Amarna, had Hebrews there. There are actually some Hebrew inscriptions there, which almost prove it beyond doubt. So when Akhenaten is dethroned, probably killed, his people are dispersed all over the place. The priests, the Hebrews, the Levites, Levi was one of the sons of Jacob, who must have been officiating in the temple as priests. They disperse all over. They're probably now, their Pharaoh is no longer there to protect them. They're dispossessed of their rights. They become enslaved, if you like, but they cling on to their beliefs. And 80 or 90 years later, Moses recognizes in them something that he admires. He comes to a belief in monotheism. He takes them as his people, and he takes them out of Egypt. We know the story of the Exodus. And even in the Bible, it says he came out with a mixed company of Israelites, of Egyptians, and priests. Some of the names of the priests are even Egyptian names. So this priestly strain comes out with Moses and comes into the Promised Land and maintain somewhat in secret some of the knowledge and possessions probably as well that they brought out from Egypt. And
so even though they came out of Egypt, it sounds like even just the little bit that we've touched on, and I know we're going to get into more detail about what their beliefs were that set them apart from Jews, but it almost sounds like they almost couldn't be considered a sect of Judaism other than they were monotheistic. I mean, it almost sounds like that's kind of the only thing they have in common.
But they did believe in large portions of the biblical texts, but they had their own version of those texts, and they revered the patriarchs just as the normal community around them did. But they clearly had a vision of a different kind of Judaism, a different temple even. They detested the temple in Jerusalem. The second temple built by King Herod, to them was a place they wouldn't go to and they didn't worship at. And they had their own version, as you say, of a religion. In a sense, yes, you could say they were virtually a different religion, although they believed in one God. They believed in things that just didn't collate with the surrounding community. And they had a unique religion, yes.
So actually, for the people that are listening, maybe you could spend a minute kind of talking about, you know, some tenets of mainstream Judaism, and then in relationships, some of the tenets, you know, or differences that really did make the Essenes different from mainstream Judaism.
Okay. Well, we've already mentioned...
I told you I was going to make you work, Robert. Sorry.
Yeah, you are. Yeah. We've already mentioned the fact that they followed a solar calendar. That in itself is radically different. They had a different form of burial to the rest of the community. They buried their dead in very simple, shallow graves with no adornments whatsoever. They didn't put their dead into tombs or ossuaries as the rest of the community did. They believed in predestination, that things were... that they had an influence on their lives, but it was all ordained for them, preordained in a sense. That was quite different from conventional religious belief. In Judaism, you're the master of your own fate. You know, your life is there. You can be do wrong or you can do right. It's up to you. They believed in good and evil. And that's not a Jewish concept. It's a Christian concept. They believed that there were sons of light and sons of darkness. They looked for two messiahs. They were waiting for two messiahs, a kingly messiah and a priestly messiah. They believed in immortality. That's something that was not normally conceived of in Judaism. And one of the main threads running through their philosophy was they were waiting for an apocalyptic age. They were looking to the end of days when all the sons of darkness would be destroyed in a final battle by the sons of light. And, guess who was going to lead the forces of light in that final battle?
No telling.
Yeah. Well, they write about it in what's called the War Scroll, one of the seven major scrolls found in Cave 1. The person who's going to lead is called Merira, and he's a prince. He's going to lead their forces into battle. Guess who Merira is in relation to Pharaoh Akhenaten?
I don't know. Who?
His high priest. His high priest is also known as Merira. We know that from reading inscriptions from tombs relating to Amarna. And the War Scroll that the Dead Sea Scrolls Qumran community wrote called him a prince, which is strange for a high priest to be a prince. But oddly enough, we know that Merira was an hereditary prince in his own right, quite unusual for a high priest. So another huge link back. They believed in dualism. That's a belief in good and evil, which came through into Christianity. It wasn't a concept in Judaism. There's no concept of good and evil. You're born good. In Christianity, you're born bad, as it were, and you've got to make good. The original sin, which...
have to get baptized.
You have to get baptized to become good. So I think what's happened is that belief that was existing at this community jumped through into Christianity. This original
well, and
sin.
Also, you know, one of the concepts that I believe came out of Qumran was the whole idea of resurrection and raising of the dead. I mean, didn't they find evidence supporting that in the Dead Sea Scrolls?
Yes, they believed in immortality. They believed in resurrection, and they believed at the end days that the good people would come back, as it were, to reclaim their right. They focused really on the ideas of a Holy Spirit, which does appear in Christian philosophy, but it's not the same kind of Holy Spirit in Judaism. There isn't that kind of internal Holy Spirit. They believed, and they had celibacy, and they wrote about only having one wife throughout your life. And they also, although they were a celibate male-only community, their text wrote about women as being on an equal footing with men in religious terms. That's something that was a bit alien to Judaism, alien to Islam, and unfortunately alien to Christianity as well. I mean, in Catholicism, women are not given the same kind of privileges as men.
That could be a whole soapbox issue right there. I mean, what I find interesting is that the things that you're talking about, the beliefs that were fundamental to the Essenes, do sound very Christian in nature as opposed to sounding Jewish in nature.
Well, if you start, I mean, having sort of written a book on the Copper Scroll, the mystery of the Copper Scroll of Qumran, which it was turned into a documentary and has been translated and produced all around the world. I then started looking at exactly as you say, I noticed the similarities in the New Testament to texts in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and I thought, well, if these are sort of secretive documents, and some of them appear to be very, very secretive because they talk about them as being their own mysterious belonging to them material, some of it even in encrypted, how much comes through into the New Testament? And Paul is probably the clearest marker of the understanding of the early followers of Jesus. I don't sort of like to refer to them as Christians yet, because they aren't. It's the kind of early Jesus movement. And Paul, most scholars accept that he was probably the earliest person to write about Jesus. Perhaps within 30 to 40 years of Jesus' crucifixion, Paul, the Acts of Paul, and his letters, are considered to predate the other Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So if there was going to be a connection to the text that the Yahad, this community at Qumran, wrote and collated, it would be in Paul. The clearest examples would be in Paul. And they are. They are. The strongest. And people refer to them as parallelisms, you know, but they're not parallelisms. They're congruent. They're the same source. They come from the same source. And there's one particular document amongst many, many others which illustrates it very clearly. It's something called 4QMMT. It was found in Cave 4. They found something like 85,000 fragments, some whole scrolls, some tiny pieces, in the various 11 caves near to this settlement at Qumran. And so 4Q was from Cave 4, and there were 15,000 fragments found there. And they were partly biblical texts that we know from the Bible, partly apocalyptic, pseudepigraphic material, and their own sectarian writings. And this one, 4QMMT, which is known as Miksav HaTorah, is the rules laid down for the holy writings. That phrase doesn't appear in any other Hebrew source at all, but it appears 8 times. Exactly the same term appears in Paul. He knew that text. He was familiar with it. He must have had a great close connection to the Qumran Essenes, as I think Jesus did and John the Baptist as well.
Well, let's talk about John the Baptist, you know, since we're trying to be a little chronological here, because John the Baptist obviously came before Jesus, and according to, you know, Christianity, he heralded in his arrival. And so What was John the Baptist, I mean, other than he was baptizing him, but what leads you to believe that John the Baptist was associated with the Essenes, with the Essene movement?
If you ask any biblical scholars, and particularly Dead Sea scholars, if they think John the Baptist had anything to do with Qumran, you'll find the spectrum goes from right extreme fundamentalist religious denominations to liberal religious denominations to secular, and there's a complete correlation between the right fundamentalist religious sector doesn't believe he had anything to do with Qumran, and the more you go to the left, you find they say, yes, he was, and eventually you come to what I call objective scholars who don't have a religious axe to grind, and they say, well, he was almost certainly a member of the Qumran Essenes. All the evidence points to it. And if you look at his teachings as recorded in the New Testament, and in Josephus as well, we know quite a lot about John the Baptist from external sources, from just Flavius Josephus, a writer who lived right up until 100 AD. He writes about John the Baptist. And John the Baptist's behavior reflects an awful lot of things that were practiced at Qumran. So I believe from those sources of evidence that John the Baptist was a member of the Qumran community. I also believe, well, for another reason, and this is because I had a lot of conversations with, at the time I spoke to him, he was a lapsed Catholic priest, Father Joseph Millick. Joseph Millick was, I would suggest, the greatest translator and interpreter of the Dead Sea Scroll material. He was a genius in his own right. He spoke and understood about 15 different biblical historical languages, and he was the fastest translator of any, working at the Rockefeller Museum in Jerusalem. John Rockefeller endowed a place where they could work and study the scrolls. And Millick, Father Millick, was the top scholar there. Now, I had the privilege to have long conversations with him later in his life when he left the Catholic Church, got married, and became virtually a recluse. And he told me a lot of the things that he not only learnt but excavated at Qumran. And he was convinced that John the Baptist was a member of the Qumran community.
You know, one of the things you mentioned was about documentation by Josephus and maybe some of the other early writers about John the Baptist, which, you know, makes him, quote-unquote, a historical figure. Was there any writings about Jesus, you know, found out there? I mean, you would think, I mean, in retrospect, you know, Jesus has become a very important figure, but was he viewed as being important enough to document back in the day, you know, back when his whole mission started?
That's a sore point for Christian theology, because there's virtually no contemporary mention of Jesus except in relation to John the Baptist. He certainly seems to be a secondary figure to John the Baptist in historical documents. He's referred to in Josephus, and the versions of Josephus that we have today refer to him as a divine figure, but the original text clearly didn't. It's an addition, a later addition. Jesus is referred to as a good man, as a good person. And in relation to John the Baptist, that's about virtually the only contemporary reference. There are references within 50, 60 years, perhaps less, of his crucifixion, but we have very, very thin evidence to his actual existence and personality. That mainly comes from the New Testament, which I think one has to concede was composed at least 40 or 50 years after Jesus. And when I say composed, I mean a lot of it kind of not made up, but certainly free in its descriptive ability to relate to real events. You just don't know how real the descriptions in the New Testament are.
I don't know. It's a matter of mystery. Well, I mean, and if you think about it, you know, when they had the Council of Nicaea in 332 A.D., and they decided to get rid of half of, quote-unquote, Christianity as it existed at that point in time. They got rid of all the Gnostics. They got rid of anybody else that didn't support that one belief system. We really don't know what the full extent of early Christianity encompassed.
I think if we look, you're absolutely right, we don't. But if you look at the text in the Dead Sea Scroll material, you probably get pretty near to the basis of the beliefs that that Jesus took out from Qumran, because I happen to believe that Jesus as well was a member of Qumran. And I also believe he's buried near there. In fact, I pretty
so
well
what
know.
Leads you know, what in Jesus' teachings leads you to believe that he was also associated, you know, or his life and teachings that lead you to believe that he was associated with Qumran?
Mainly if you analyze the text of the New Testament, because that's all we've got to go on. And we can only assume that he brought out a lot of that information. He clearly was a figure of immense stature, a prophet in the lineage of prophets. If he's divine, that's fine, you know. He could well be divine for Christians, but he certainly was in the line of prophets, of the Hebrew prophets, because his profound effect is evident to this day. I mean, you don't as an insignificant figure, found a religion that now is the major religion of the world. All right, Paul elaborated on it. Paul put it down in writing, as did the gospel writers. But nevertheless, there has to be something that they have centered that's inspired them, and I think that's Jesus. And Jesus' writings must have come through to them, his words, and by word of mouth, if you like, to the gospel writers and to Paul. And they are consistent with the teachings of what was going on at Qumran. But clearly an awful lot has been added to and taken from conventional biblical existing material. And there's no reason to believe that the New Testament doesn't take similar existing material from the Dead Sea Scroll material as well. I mean, a lot of theologians were absolutely gobsmacked. I don't know, is that an American expression?
Not commonly used, no. But I think we get it.
It means, you know, like a punch in the mouth almost. They could not believe when it happened, what happened, that the present Pope, Benedict XVI, in his Easter message, I think it was 2 years ago, came out with the incredible statement that he believed Jesus partook of the Last Supper according to Essene rites. Effectively, he was saying that he believed Jesus was an Essene. And that threw a lot of Christian theologians into a sheer panic, because no pope has ever said anything like that before. And I think the Pope knows things about Qumran and the early formations of Christianity that we don't. And he's come to the conclusion that Jesus was a member of Qumran. If you look at the conventional...
Well, what would be so bad about that?
Nothing at all. Actually, it's great. It's actually... there's no problem, except an awful lot of people, in a way, are worshipping Jesus or revering places where Jesus is supposed to have been. And they should be actually going and revering Qumran. because that's where he probably spent most of his early life. If you look at the New Testament, there's nothing about Jesus' life between the age of 12 and 30. And that in itself is just is quite remarkable. Where was he? What was he doing for 18 years?
Well, you know, there are some people that say that he went into India and studied with the mystics in India.
Well, it's not beyond belief. It's not beyond possibility. I kind of doubt it myself, but there is some evidence in India, yes. But it's the most formative period of his life, when he's, you know, he's most creative. And you'd think, well, he's going to be doing a lot of amazing things between the age of 12 and 30. But no, there's no record of any of his activities between those two periods. Why is that? 12 is probably here, but he's brought out at Jerusalem. He appears at Jerusalem, which is probably equivalent to his bar mitzvah, his coming of age, if you like. And he's brought to the temple at Jerusalem. That's it. There's nothing else about him until 30, when he starts his ministry at the age of 30.
There a significance about that age, about the age of 30?
Oh, you put your finger right on it, yes. 30 is the minimum age that a fully-fledged member of the Qumran community can start practicing his beliefs. Before that, he's not a full member of the community. Age 30 is the exact age when he reaches graduation and he has a final cleansing of his soul, if you like, by a baptismal ceremony in flowing water. And then he's now a full member, voting member of the Council of Qumran. I think he is such a strong, powerful figure that he can no longer be contained within the confines of Qumran. And so he leaves, or maybe he's pushed out because they just can't accept now that he has full voting rights, that he's going to be such a strong force in their community. So they perhaps eject him, or he leaves of his own volition, and he goes and follows John the Baptist, or finds John the Baptist, who baptizes him.
Well, I mean, as far as the Essenes belief system, I mean, there are some, you know, religious organizations even today that one of their basic tenets is proselytization, you know, going out and sharing the word with the masses. I mean, did the Essenes have that same kind of belief? Or was, you know, going out and interacting with the regular people not really something that they did?
The community of Qumran probably numbered about 150 to 200 at any one time over a period of about 130 years. They didn't actually live on this site. If you go to Qumran today, you'll see a lot of the ruins of the buildings and the cemetery and the aqueducts that they built, because water was in extreme short supply. You'll see the caves where the scrolls that they hid when they finished their day's work, and they lived in the caves. Reaching another break.
Yeah, we are. But it's the last one. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. We're talking to Robert Feather about his book, The Secret Initiation of Jesus at Qumran. And we will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages. Hi, I'm James Othayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feet2fire.com for more information.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today.
You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.
Before we get back to the show, I want to thank all of you for tuning into Just Energy Radio this evening. Many of the people I've helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you're at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email. We can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
And welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we're here talking to Robert Feather about his book, The Secret Initiation of Jesus at Qumran. And Robert, we actually have a question from the chat room, which I thought was interesting. And the question is what do you think about the reliability of the Apocrypha?
Some of them, I think, might predate the scriptures, the New Testament. Synoptic Gospels. I assume that the question is talking about the Nag Hammadi Gospels, the so-called Gnostic Gospels. There's evidence that some of them relate to material found at Oxyrhynchus in Egypt. These were found in Egypt, these documents. Now, that's a strange phenomena, that most of the early Christian biblical texts were found in Egypt, not in Italy or Israel, but in Egypt. And the Gnostic Gospels, the Apocrypha, as it were, which are material that was, as you say, when Constantine came to adopt Christianity and turn the whole of the Roman Empire Christian. The Apocrypha Gnostic material was relegated and banned, but it's resurfaced and may well contain a lot more. Some of them talk about the word being the words of Jesus, and may well be that there's more reliability in those texts than in the Synoptic Gospels. Yes.
And when they look at like the Nag Hammadi Library, you know, can they? Where do they date those texts? Do they date from around the time of Christ, or are they later, you know, later versions? I'm sure that they've, you know, put some kind of date to the actual, like, parchment or papyrus, but can they date where the, you know, based on grammar and syntax, a period of time when they were actually written?
Yes, they're... On those terms, they're dated to around the 3rd, 4th century. That's true. They're quite a bit long later than Jesus. But nevertheless, they appeared to be copies of earlier material. And some of the sense of what they're saying seems to be much more convincing as being authentic than the potentially or assumed earlier Synoptic New Testament scripts. So I think there's good evidence from Oxyrhynchus as well, as your other biblical New Testament type texts, but they were very early, yes.
Okay, so here's, you know, one of the more recent controversies that you hear going around, because there's the Book of Mary, or Mary Magdalene, and there's, and she kissed him on the blank. And so there's the group of people that say that Jesus and Mary were married, which would go along with traditional Judaism, which you get married when you're young, and if not, you get estranged from your family, which would put Jesus and Mary together in a relationship. Or he, you know, was part of the Essenes, and there was no relationship, or maybe there was, which might have been against, you know, their doctrine. It might have gotten them in trouble in the first place. You know, do you have any comments about the relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene?
I do, and in the Book of Thomas it does talk about those kind of relationships. I think it's highly likely that he had women in his entourage and that he befriended Mary Magdalene. That's very, very possible. Whether he married her, I think that's probably unlikely. It's true that it was normal for a Jewish person of that age, 30 plus, to be married. It would be abnormal not to be. But he'd been celibate, certainly, I think, until he was 30 and he came out and started his ministry. And I think it's unlikely that he got married. I think, strangely enough, the reason the Pope may have come out with this remarkable statement, although I think it's a true statement, frankly, was to put a cap on the speculation that Jesus got married. If he was a member of the Qumran community, a celibate community, he would have remained celibate and not married. So it's kind of a lesser of two evils in a way. Let's have Jesus as a member of the Qumran community, therefore he can't get married, and all this nonsense about him having children, going off to live in south of France with Mary Magdalene is nonsense. I don't find any real evidence for that, except, as you say, in the Gnostic Gospels, there are indications that he had a relationship with Mary, but there's no indication directly that he got married to or had children. And I think there's very little reality to the fact that he died on the cross, that he was crucified, and that he died on the cross. But I don't think he's buried in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where people go to commemorate his place of entombment. I don't think he's buried there at all for 1 minute.
Because in the early Christian texts, they really didn't have the concept of Jesus being the Messiah and rising in the flesh.
No.
Did they?
No.
And so if he didn't rise in the flesh and, you know, they go to the tomb and it's empty and, you know, it kind of makes me laugh because, you know, when I think of Jesus going to the 12 apostles, you know, after the fact, it was, you know, the ghost of Jesus showing up, not Jesus in the flesh. But if Jesus in the flesh rose, then the tomb would be empty. You know, it becomes one of those conundrum kind of things. So, but in the early Christian church, there was no, you know, saying anything about him rising in the flesh from the dead, correct? And
yes.
So if he didn't rise in the flesh from the, if he didn't rot, if his flesh didn't get up, okay, I'm just going to say it. So if his, you know, formerly dead body didn't get up and walk away, then he would have to be buried somewhere.
Yeah, I think he is. I think he's buried somewhere near Qumran. And I have a pretty good idea of the place. In fact, I know it. I know the place.
You know the place?
I know the place, yes. I mean, first
is
of all,
you secret?
Have to... I mean, I don't think I can reveal it, frankly, because if I did and I'm right, then there's going to be mayhem, people going down there and digging it up, which I don't want. Who would want that? And if I'm wrong, then I'm wrong, and I'm saying something that I shouldn't be saying. But the thought that he's buried in the tomb of the Holy Sepulchre, There's two places where he's thought to be buried, the Garden Tomb in Jerusalem, which was identified by General Gordon in the 19th century, quite a late discovery, and that's not really got terribly much going for it. And there's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which has been investigated, and the tomb, if there is a tomb under there, it was a long ancient tomb and not a new carved one as it's supposed to be. And I think he's buried. He wasn't left in a tomb. And in fact, Paul talks about Jesus being buried, not left in a tomb. And if he's the earliest recorder of events, then we have to take his word as prime. There are texts underlying Matthew, Mark, and Luke, which have identified something called Q, which is a kind of an under all three of them text, which they all draw on. And you can see the common denominators that they draw on appear in each. And Q does not talk about the Passion story, about the crucifixion. It's as if it didn't know about it, which is a bit weird. They don't mention the Passion crucifixion, I think, in Q, because it's written before he died. But that's another story, really.
Yeah, because, I mean, Christianity, you know, well, certain branches of Christianity in particular really focus on that period of time, that four-day window, you know, between Holy Thursday, I guess it's Holy Thursday and Easter Sunday, you know, this whole unfolding of events leading up to the resurrection or the finding of the empty tomb on Easter Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, I have difficulty in expressing opinion on this because I believe that Jesus was a holy man, a very, very holy person. Divine is another matter, and that's a religious belief, and that's okay. But that he was crucified, yes. That he was buried in Jerusalem, no. I think he's taken back to where he was brought up, at Qumran. And he's buried somewhere near there, not at Qumran, but quite, in fact, some distance from it, because he's persona non grata to them, but nevertheless they cared for him, and they took him back when he died.
But even when you look at the Gnostic texts, you know, which to me, you can't throw those away, you know, because I think that they were just bumped out of history, and I think they have a lot of validity as to what early Christianity was about. And even in those texts, it doesn't refer to Jesus as being divine. They refer to him as being a great teacher and having all of these philosophical beliefs, but not as God incarnate.
Yes, and I think the Gnostic texts, the apocryphal texts, probably are pretty accurate. They don't actually say that Jesus was married or had children, and people have read far, far too much into them in that respect. They do illuminate sayings of Jesus, the actual sayings of Jesus, and they may well be correct. And I think, you know, they shouldn't have been relegated. But the early church seemed to take a view that it was going to be dominated by men, that they were going to be in charge, and therefore the role of women was relegated. And the Gnostic Gospels and the Apocrypha had women pretty well on an equal with Jesus, and they didn't seem to like that, so they got rid of the text.
So let me ask this question: how much did Saul have to do with actually the formation of what we now see as contemporary Christianity?
An awful lot. But I think again the thread that comes through from Jesus and John the Baptist from Qumran is extant in Paul. If you recall, Paul, he was persecutor of Christians initially. And then he saw the light. On the road to Damascus, he had a revelation. He saw the spirit of Jesus, he says, and became a believer and became the greatest fan of Jesus and his teachings. But what happened after that revelation in Damascus, by the way, which I think is probably a community of Essenes, because they weren't just located at Qumran. There's about 4,000 of them spread around in Israel, and there was a community at Damascus. He has a revelation on the road to Damascus, and then what happens? He disappears for a few years. He goes into the desert. I think he goes to an Essene community, and he also learns all the teachings and philosophy of the Essenes. That's why he's able to incorporate them so clearly into his writings.
That's really fascinating.
But there's no explanation in the New Testament what he was doing for those years after he has his revelation. He just goes off into the desert, disappears.
So were the other apostles also associated to some extent with the Essenes or their philosophy?
I doubt so strongly. They seem to be writing quite a bit later, maybe 60, 70, 80 years later after Jesus has been killed. So they are drawing on memory, hearsay, legend, perhaps some written down material, but I think they're drawing on their own ideas as much as anything. Paul is the strongest witness to Jesus.
And he didn't even know him.
Didn't even know.
So where did? I mean, other than, well, what? This is an interesting question. So other than your belief that he spent time with the Essenes and him killing early Christians, where would he even be introduced to Jesus's teachings? I mean, because, you know, if you're going to bump somebody off and you take them captive and you're doing whatever to them, you're not really listening to the dogma that they're telling.
I don't know.
So where would he even, you know, learn any of this stuff?
I don't know. Perhaps just in associating with Christians, he started to hear what they were teaching, and something struck him and gelled, and he said, "Gee, I'm persecuting these people, but they're teaching something that is making me feel good, and perhaps I'm doing the wrong thing." And he had a revelation. When you ask about the other writers of the New Testament, if you look at some of the key elements that they include in their story, they're all culled. A lot of them are culled from the existing Hebrew Bible. The gall and vinegar that's given to Jesus on the cross comes in from Psalm 69. The casting of lots for his clothes from Psalm 22. Darkness at noon, Amos 8:9. The trial collaboration, Psalm 2. His side shall be not pierced. His side was pierced by a spear. That's an interest to me. That appears in Zechariah in the Hebrew Bible, chapter 12, verse 10. I did a study of the spear that was thrust into the side of Jesus while he was on the cross. I was given access to the spear that's in the Vienna Museum to examine it and try and determine whether it was authentic. It could possibly be, but you can't rule it out, but that's almost the subject of another discussion. But the point is that a lot of the things in the New Testament about the events of the crucifixion are taken from the Old Testament.
And so the facts of what actually happened and transpired in the primary books of the Bible might be a little bit made up, maybe? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, they used existing texts. They employed them in their descriptions. It doesn't mean that the core event is not true, but to describe it, they had to find the detail, and they found a lot of the detail from earlier descriptions, the suffering servant in Isaiah, and these things that the fact that his legs shall not be broken, that really comes from Exodus 12 and Numbers 9, where there's an injunction that the bones shall not be broken. They latched onto these things and applied them.
But wouldn't that just help to make their point, you know, that
yes,
he is fulfilling prophecy and he is the Messiah? You know, there is a, and I don't know where it came from, you know, that he will enter the city through the eastern gate, you know, and that was somewhere and he did that, which it makes me kind of laugh because, you know, if he knew the Bible, then he would know that he needs to enter through the eastern gate. But, you know, that's another whole topic. You know, but they're, in order to validate their claim of his, you know, being the Messiah, he would need to fulfill certain prophecies or statements made about who he was, wouldn't he?
Yes, and so that's right, and so he did. So they wrote those up correctly. That's, I suppose, what we would expect, and the evidence is there that they culled material from other texts. But the Bible does that all the time. It draws on older texts to validate whatever it's writing about. When you say he entered via the eastern gate, this is on the eve before the crucifixion, the before the Last Supper.
It was Palm Sunday, you know, that Sunday before, and they throw the palms around, and he's entering through the eastern gate.
There's a very interesting passage in the New Testament relating to that. I think it's in Luke 22, chapter 8 of. Chapter 22, verse 8 onwards, where Jesus says to his disciples, he says to Peter and John, go into Jerusalem and ask someone. He says, go in, enter the city, and you'll see a man who's carrying water. Ask him to prepare a house for the master in a chamber for the Passover. And that's all he says, which is a very odd thing to say. Peter and John have got to go into a city teeming with people, look for someone carrying water, and he's going to take them to a house and prepare a room for the Last Supper.
That's like saying to somebody, you know, at a Grateful Dead concert, look for the guy with the long hair, beard, and tie-dye T-shirt.
It's not a very good description. No, pretty ambiguous. But if you analyze it carefully, I think you find the kind of reasoning that the Pope Benedict XVI was using applies. Because what man would be carrying water in a city of Jerusalem? In those days, a man would not carry water. It would be a woman or it would be a slave. Only people who would carry water would be Essenes, because they didn't have women in their community and they didn't have slaves. So if they're carrying water, they're an Essene. So Jesus is saying something that's quite unambiguous to Peter and John. He's saying, look for someone, and you'll actually, they don't understand what he's saying, but the reality is that he's telling them to find someone who will be an Essene. And it was the custom for the Essenes to offer a house hospitality to their members wherever they appeared. And that's, I think, what happens. And it also actually confirms almost absolutely that Jesus was in Essene. And they're referring to him as the Master, which is a title used in the Essene community. He goes into an area which is near the Essene Gate. It's called the Essene Gate to this day in the old city of Jerusalem. And that area, strangely enough, has a community that claims to be the oldest form of Christianity. I think it's the Armenian Quarter. And they claim to be the oldest Christian group in the world. Not surprising. Yeah, yeah.
So, Robert, this time has gone way too fast, and I feel like we've only picked a little teeny piece of the infinite amount of knowledge that you have. And so, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask, because we have like 2 or so minutes left, is do you have any new books coming up or any classes or conferences you're going to be speaking at so people can get some more of your wisdom?
I've got 3 books in the pipeline. I hope my literary agent performs at the Frankfurt Book Fair and gets them taken up for publishing. And one is on is actually a fiction based on fact, or based on the spear of Jesus, the spear that was allegedly thrust into his side. The other one's a biography of Father Millick, this Catholic, lapsed Catholic priest that I mentioned. And I'm also doing one on holes in the Dead Sea Scrolls, the anomalies and things that they've got patently wrong in the Dead Sea Scrolls. I'm speaking at a conference in London, if anyone's around, September 20th, at Kensington Town Hall on Sunday morning in London. And I'm hoping to come over to America in May, because I come to Washington every 2 years to play chess. And I'm going to give some talks over there in Washington. When I'm there, and perhaps in other places in America, but that's in the 2010.
Well, you'll have to come by. You know, if you come through Dallas, you'll have to let me know.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to.
So,
I really.
So, Robert, if somebody. Oh, go ahead.
I just so much enjoyed talking to you, because you've drawn me out and made me rethink a lot of things, which is good.
Well, I told you, I read this whole book cover to cover. So if somebody wanted to get a copy of your book, The Secret Initiation of Jesus, where would they go to get it?
There's a version published in America by Inner Traditions. You can get it direct from them, or it's on Amazon. Amazon.com has got it. Just Google my name or search on Amazon, and you'll find the book, and you can buy it through them. All the books, in fact, are available on Amazon.
Yeah, because we're going to have you come back so we can talk about the spear and, you know, catch up. I mean, I only went through like 1.5 pages of my notes. So, again, Robert, thank you very much for coming on the show, and we will have you back.
Thank you, Dr. Reed.
All right, you have a great night. And next week, we have Eldon Taylor talking about mind programming, and I think that you need to listen to find out how you might be being controlled by the media. And so, until next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. If you're enjoying this program and you're listening to Blog Talk, please click me on as a favorite or sign up for our newsletter at www.justenergyradio.com. But until next week, be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.